Hi everyone, welcome to the Set Python Girls Club podcast. I am your host, Madeline.
And I'm your co-host, Luciana. Let's get started.
Hi Luciana, how's it going?
Hey Madeline, I am doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And today for this second episode, we have a guest. Hi Brett.
Hi, you too. How are you?
We're good. Thank you. How are you?
A little sick, but I'm hyped up on adrenaline for being on the podcast, so all good.
Ooh. Well, don't give us your germs via the internet gremlins, please. Thank you.
All right. Do my best.
Thank you. For those who don't know Brett, well, actually, Brett, why don't you introduce yourself?
Oh, God. Okay. So, yeah, my name is Brett Cannon. I live in Vancouver. On the unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. I am a dev manager at Microsoft, lucky enough to work with the both of you. In terms of Python, I have been on the development team for Python for 19 years at this point. I'm a member of the Python Steering Council since its founding. And I think that's the general summary of it all at this point.
19 years.
Mm-hmm.
You've been on the Python team for longer than some of our interns, right?
Well, so Eleanor, our last intern, I've been programming in Python as long as she's been around on this planet. But I still not quite matched an intern yet for as long as I've been on the Python team. Because I learned Python originally in the fall of 2000.
That's a while ago.
Yeah. So approaching 22 years.
Luciana, what were you doing in the year 2000?
I was actually 6 years old. I do remember watching TV when the horrific news of the World Trade Center reached Brazil. So I just remember watching a lot of TV. That's what I was probably doing around that year.
I wasn't much older than that. I don't really remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's been a while. Well, Brett, you've been on the Python, you've been working with Python for like almost 20 years now. How long have you been at Microsoft?
I came to Microsoft in July 2015. So I've been at the company just shy of 7 years as of this recording.
Ooh. And how did you get to Microsoft?
So I was actually working at Google on a product called Google Now, which is no longer quite a thing, but it became kind of part of Google Assistant. And my wife, Andrea, and I were out in Greater Ontario area. And my wife's born and raised here in Vancouver. And I went to do my PhD here at the University of British Columbia. So we knew Vancouver. And honestly, we just missed it. Family, friends, etc. West Coast life, as it were. So we decided to move back. And when it came to start looking for work, I just reached out to my network of friends that I have in the Python community. And some of my friends happened to work at Microsoft. And I just said, hey, I know you got an office in Vancouver. Do you think you'd be up for hiring me and let me work from the Vancouver office? And they said, yeah, I think so. And then they double checked with management. And it's like, yeah, totally. We already have one person remote on the team. So why don't we have you come join, move to Vancouver, work out of the Vancouver office, be a remote member of the team. And that's that. And then I decided, sure, why not? And then joined Microsoft.
And what was that team doing here at Microsoft at the time?
So back then, that was the Python team in the data group. And it was doing two things mainly. And I kind of helped add a third. So it was keeping PTVS, the Python Tools for Visual Studio plugin, running. At the time, they were developing Azure Notebooks. It hadn't been announced yet. And I also came on and started to do kind of internal consulting, as it were, for Python. Python wasn't quite so big within Microsoft at the time, but it was starting to slowly grow. And so teams would come seeking out Python expertise within the company, and they'd inadvertently find our team and they'd ask for some help. And then I'd sometimes get sent to talk to the team, just to help them with API design, how to approach the Python community, how to promote something, et cetera, et cetera. Just basically how to be a member of the Python community. And yeah, that's how I got started.
And so at that time, the Python extension wasn't a Microsoft thing.
For VS Code, no, it definitely was not. Not in 2015, at least. What happened there was Don Giamatti, the original creator of the extension, joined Microsoft in September of 2017. And earlier that year, I'd been asked to look at how hard it would be to make a Python extension from scratch. And I dabbled in it a bit and said, it's doable. But while I was doing that, they started to talk with Don about him coming here. He went to Redmond and he got hired. And when he got hired, he brought the extension with him. And so he and I got paired up and I was kind of unofficially the dev lead for the team, although I basically just let Don do his thing. And then we very quickly started to staff the team up, as you both know, be members of the team. And we've been running the extension doing this extension here at Microsoft ever since. And I guess at this point, I've been working on the extension longer than anybody else on the planet, which is a little scary.
Longer than anybody else on the planet. It's like living memory, you know, like we kind of need to pick your brain one of these days.
Yes, it is a bit weird, even on Python, right? Like when I first joined the development team, Tim Peters was like the institutional memory of the team because he'd been around for quite a while and done a lot of key things. Like he implemented dictionaries. There's a sorting algorithm named after Tim called TimSort that Java copied.
What?
Yeah, if you don't know, the actual sorting algorithm used by Java is actually copied from Python and it's called TimSort. Anyway, I've now been around long enough that I'm now starting to become the institutional memory on some things, which is just really weird.
Do you want to have a sorting algorithm named after you, Red Sort? What would it look like?
I don't know, but I don't think I'm good enough at algorithms to ever implement a sorting algorithm. I managed to dodge taking algorithms in university all the way until my PhD, and then I took it, and I actually didn't get a high enough of a grade for it to count towards my PhD, so I had to do extra credit work to get my grade up. So I'm the last person you want to ask to develop a novel algorithm.
Speaking of your educational background, Rhett, your bachelor's is something that whenever you bring it up, people are a little bit surprised. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I took a very circuitous route through all of my post-secondary education. So I went to junior college in the United States, even though I live in Canada now. And so that's kind of like college in Canada, where you go for about 2 years and then you typically transfer to a four-year university. And while I was doing my 2 years at junior college, my mom made me promise her to take a course in computer science and a course in philosophy because she figured you probably love both. And at the time, I was actually thinking about going into genetics. I took a course in each and I absolutely loved both. And at that point, I decided, you know what? I'm going to try to double major in computer science and philosophy because one just totally just blew my mind and I absolutely loved it. That was philosophy. And computer science I loved as well, but I also knew I could at least pay the bills with a computer science degree. And then I subsequently transferred to UC Berkeley in the University of California system in the state of California. And I subsequently found out that there was a unit cap where you could only have so many units before they kicked you out of university, so you couldn't be a lifetime student because it's a public university system and they had to make sure there was enough room for kids to be able to get in. So I had to make a decision to either do computer science or do philosophy. And to get into the philosophy program at Berkeley, you basically have to go into the office, tell them you want to do it. They ask you, are you absolutely sure? Do you know what you're doing? This is philosophy. And you say yes, and then they let you become a philosophy major versus computer science where you have to apply. So at the time, during the boom times of the early 2000s, I was like, okay, I'll get a philosophy degree, and then I'll just take as many CS courses as I can, and I'll still get a job when I graduate. So that's what I did. And then subsequently, the bust happened, and then I said, oh, well, I come from a long line of educators and teachers and stuff. I said, I'll go do a PhD. And then I went and did my master's degree at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, actually where one of the halves of the Jupyter Notebooks program actually used to be from. And actually the other half was from Berkeley. So I have a weird tie to Jupyter that way. And then transferred up to the University of British Columbia to do the PhD, which is where I met my wife and decided academia wasn't for me and went off to Google and then ended up here.
It did take a leap year around that time.
Yeah. So if you don't count the internships, I had 6 months off between junior college and starting at Berkeley. And then I had another gap year that I took a year off from finishing my philosophy degree and starting my computer science master's degree. And that's actually when I got heavily involved with Python and the development team. I had at the time gotten the largest and last recipe into the first edition of the Python cookbook from O'Reilly. And it was basically implementing a function called stirptime. It's actually still there in the Python standard library. It's under the time module and available through datetime as well. And I had come up with a way to basically parse date and time strings. The deal was at the time it wasn't available on Windows, which is what I was running because I was a gamer. And so I re-implemented the algorithm, but you had to list out like the names of the months. So like you had to write out that, okay, the first month is named January and the second month is named February. It always bugged me that you had to write that out, even though you probably only do it once. And during my last year of my undergrad, I figured out how to use str f time, which is the inverse function, which you give it a date time and it'll make the string format the way you want. And I figured out how to use that to actually get the names of the dates and the months and all that stuff. And as a graduation gift to myself to show you how much of a computer nerd I am, I spent the week after I graduated implementing my idea, and it worked. And so I went to Alex Martelli, the editor of the Python cookbook, and said, hey, I think this might be useful in Python. Do you think they'd take it? And if so, how do I get it in? And he said, yeah, maybe. Go sign up for this mailing list called Python Dev and just ask them and they'll tell you how to do it. And so I did. And I said, I did this thing. And they walked me through the process of submitting a patch on SourceForge way back in the day for CVS. And it got in. And I enjoyed the experience so much. And I was taking a year off to apply to grad school. I said I'd stick around, keep doing it. Figured it'd look good on the applications to say I was involved with Python's development somehow. And I stuck around and did it so much for that year that April 2018, 2003, after the first PyCon, Guido okayed me getting commit rights.
This is amazing. Some people take gap years to travel around the world, and some people take it to contribute to open source. This is really cool.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I had enough friends still around Berkeley at the time, either still taking courses or just hanging out or whatever, that I figured I'd just stick around and just kind of hang out and just do what I had to do to get into grad school. So it just seemed like, why not? And I ended up writing the Python Dev Summaries, which used to be a semi-monthly summary of everything that happened on the Python Dev mailing list, because there was enough email that unless you were really dedicated, you couldn't keep up. And A.M. Cushling, Andrew Cushling, used to do it. And I noticed it had stopped, so I decided to pick it up because it would force me to stay on top of the development. And it allowed me to know when little problems cropped up, right? Someone would just say in as a side, oh yeah, this would be great to get fixed. And then I just immediately raised my hand saying, hey, can I fix it? And everyone's always just like, sure, great. So I got to kind of sneak in getting it done. Plus doing the Python dev summaries allowed me to ask stupid questions without feeling stupid, because I could always just say, oh, it's for the summary. And so I just was able to just slowly just kind of just dig in more and more into Python, take on bigger and bigger projects until they just finally said, stop asking. You can just have commit rights and just do it yourself.
That's one way to get to be done with you asking questions. Talking about asking questions and asking stupid questions, how easy or difficult do you think it would be for somebody to get started in the Python community nowadays, like to get into like follow that process, like start asking questions, start contributing to Python, getting into Python dev, and just following your path? Because I assume like Python is also kind of slightly bigger now compared to when you started, right? So what do you think?
Yes, it is definitely bigger than when I started. When I started my master's, people would ask me what I did for fun or whatever, and I would say, oh, I work on Python programming language. And half the answers would response to that would be, what's that? But then the other half would be, is that language where white space matters? So this was right before Python really took off, right? That hockey stick growth, showing how Canadian I am, where it really spiked and really took off. Like about 2005 was where things really started to get exposure for Python, and it's just continued up ever since. So it was definitely a different time in terms of just how much there was to do, how big the development team was, kind of pressures we faced, right? Because back then, people used Python because they wanted to, right? I think it was maybe Jacob Kaplan-Moss from Django who once said that he knew Python had really made it when he met the first person at PyCon who said he didn't want to be there, but work made him go. That it was no longer just a passionate thing for people, but it had gotten so big that people were being forced to use Python. And so it was definitely different. In terms of people getting involved today, it's possible. It is harder, I'm not going to lie, just because the popularity of the language and its exposure to the world is so large that a lot of people want to get involved now. Back when I got involved, there is not anyone else really doing what I was doing. So I was for the longest time actually the youngest member of the development team until Benjamin Peterson came and joined the team while he was still in high school. But because there was not a huge influx of new people, it was very easy to get going and started. Now there's tons of people coming in trying to help out. So the low-hanging fruit gets snatched up pretty quick. So the thing I typically tell people who want to get involved, and to be very clear, by the way, while Python as an implementation that you get from python.org is called CPython and key bits are implemented in C, you don't have to know C. You don't even have to necessarily know that much Python. Like, you can help with translations and stuff. I have a friend who's learning Python right now, and he actually got involved by doing the Italian translation and picking that up. But you kind of have to find something you're passionate about that you can stick with. Because motivation is really hard, right? This is probably something you're going to do in your spare time when you could be doing something else. And so you have to make it something that I'm willing to not go outside and instead do this. And sometimes it might kind of be mucky and kind of boring having to do some of the stuff that might not be quite so enjoyable. So if you get involved, it kind of has to be in some way that you will stay motivated, which for some people is great and they can totally find something and they'll stick with it and they just get really energized and they just come forward and start helping out on something and it gets noticed and they just stick around and then they get offered triage rights, which lets them help add labels and stuff on issues. And then eventually if they keep doing that well and doing good reviews on PRs, then eventually they get offered a chance to join the development team. But really the key thing is to find something you're passionate about. Coming in and just saying, I want to help, honestly doesn't usually pan out because there are so many people who come with that general viewpoint that you just can't get anywhere. So you kind of have to have that thing that really pushes you to want to keep coming back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Do you manage to do a lot of Python in your day-to-day? I know that management, like people management, hello, I'm one of the people being managed. That takes a lot of time, but do you have time to do any, to code any Python or to participate in any Python meetings? Like, you're part of the steering council, right?
Yeah, so participation, definitely. Coding, not as much as I used to. So you're right, I have a steering council to do every week. We meet on Mondays right now, and then stuff for that throughout the week. I do stay on top of all the conversations. So everything that's going on the development team, I read all the emails, all the posts on Discourse at discuss.python.org. I'm heavily involved in packaging on the PyPA, the Python Packaging Association side of things. So I'm participating there. I typically am somehow involved in some PEP, whether it's one I've written or being asked to delegate on or discussions or something. So I definitely always have something going on in terms of that realm. In terms of actual coding, it varies. I try to do one PR review at least a week, if not a day, if I'm lucky. It really depends on the day. In terms of actually getting to author code myself, it's really hit or miss. It typically stems from me finishing a PEP and going, all right, this PEP now has to get implemented. So I go off and implement that part of the PEP. But yeah, it really comes and goes. So coding wise, it's nowhere near as much as back in the day, but I still try to get it in when I can. I still love coding. I don't code less because I want to code less. I code less just because I have less time for it.
Recently, you've been working on that WWBD VS Code extension. So can you tell us what WWBD means?
Sure. So one of the pieces of feedback all of us get about the Python extension is I need help setting up my environment, specifically virtual environments and Conda environments. And it's good practice to do it. So often when we bring it up with people, specifically Luciana, which she does what we call quick pulses at Microsoft, where she interviews people to get feedback and understanding of how people use our stuff. One of the things that often comes up is like, I don't know what an environment is, or I don't know how to set it up. So one of the things we're experimenting with is a new extension that I wrote called WWBD, as you said, which stands for What Would Brett Do? It's extremely opinionated, hence why my name's in the title. And it's very much designed as a way to basically go, if I were to teach my manager, Kai, how to code in Python, what kind of workflow would I expect for him? And we made a separate extension specifically to make it very clear that it's opinionated and not designed for everybody. And because honestly, I don't write a ton of TypeScript, so bugs might be there. So just be aware. But yeah, so we pushed that extension out literally the day before PyCon started. I think Luciana was literally the first download ever of that extension while at PyCon.
You took a screenshot?
We took a picture of myself downloading the extension, the first download ever. It happened live at PyCon. It was very exciting.
Wow.
People were so super thrilled with this extension as well, and we were showing it because, like Brett said, it's experimental, it's a prototype and all of that, but still, it saves a lot of time. That's one of the feedback that we keep hearing from people. It really saves time because it creates the virtual environment, install dependencies if they're there, like in requirements.txt file. And all in just one command. So that was really amazing. Can't thank you enough, you, Brett, for getting that done in time for PyCon, because people were really thrilled.
Yeah, I'm just glad it got in, got done in time. There's some more stuff I want to do. I want to like make it so like if you launch VS Code from an activated virtual environment in the terminal, we'll pick that up and automatically select it. I want to do the same thing for Conda environments. I want to detect environment.yaml files if you're a Conda user and try to do the right thing there. So there's a couple more things we want to play with, but so far so good. Biggest complaints we've gotten have been bug reports from Kartik on our team, and I fixed those last week for Luciana. And so, yeah, so far so good.
And speaking of coding in TypeScript, this is the language that VS Code extensions are written in, right? How cool will it be, Brett, if we got to code Python to implement these extensions for VS Code? Do you think that would be possible one day?
I think it's definitely possible. Our intern, Eleanor, last summer actually researched it, and it seems like it's feasible. It's a question of how much work it would be. If you follow what's been going on kind of the Python community very recently, Peter Wang gave a keynote at PyCon US about PyScript, a project he has going at Anaconda. And it's basically embedding Python code in an HTML file so that you can ship a single HTML file to someone and then have it just run using Python code. And the way it works is it uses a project called Pyodyne, which is a project that takes CPython, the main version of Python, as I said earlier, that you can get from python.org, and compiles it for WebAssembly, which you can, if you don't know, you can think of it as a platform-independent assembly language. So it's kind of like a virtual CPU in a way. And pretty much every browser supports it. And so it's kind of cool because it means you can run Python in the browser. And Pyodyne is probably the biggest implementation of that feature. And so we've talked about a lot on the team, and then we're looked into, could we take Pyodyne, ship that in a extension, because WebAssembly can be run from JavaScript, right? Which obviously TypeScript can handle. And then can we somehow make it so that we can actually just use Pyodyne to do all the logic for the extension? I think it's feasible. I just don't know how much work it would be and how brittle it would be. But I think it's still somewhat early days for this kind of embedding in terms of inside of an Electron desktop app like this. But I'm hopeful. I've gotten involved with trying to get Python itself compiling to WebAssembly cleanly so that the Pyodyne team doesn't have to handle that. And the hope is that way it'll make it easier for us to do this exact project, because I'd love to get it so that the Python extension is actually written in Python, because I want all of you on the team to be writing more Python than we do for technical reasons, obviously. And then I also want to get it so that we can actually maybe ship Pyodyne as a Python as an extension for VS Code, so that those people who don't have Python installed can just go to the marketplace, click a button, and suddenly have Python available on their machine or on vscode.dev and just be able to run code locally as necessary, at least for basic stuff.
And we are kind of already working towards having a bit more Python code in extensions with the extension tools that we are creating, right? With for Pyland, the Black formatter, iSort, and all of that, right? So in the short term, we have been working towards that. But in the long term, I know I would personally love to be able to write Python code to create extensions for Visual Studio Code, because I don't love TypeScript yet. Maybe one day.
Hey.
I'm sorry, Kim Madeline. This is why we have you.
So I would say there's kind of two levels to that. So the first level is what we're doing with the Black extension and the Pyland extension and the iSort extension that Karthik's been working on, where we're using the Language Server Protocol, or LSP. And that protocol was specifically designed by the VS Code team so that you can launch services in any language you want, right? It doesn't matter. Basically, VS Code acts as a client and talks to the server and just asks the server questions about the code you're working on, and it gets answers. So step one in all this was to get it so that the amount of TypeScript you need and what TypeScript you need to get going to like wrap a linter or wrap a formatter is as cookie cutter and as generic as possible, such that it's as small as possible and something you don't even have to think about. Because the goal for us is to have it so that people who are Python developers don't need to know TypeScript to create a VS Code extension. But the next level after that is, if LSP is not a good fit for what you want your extension to do, or to be honest, have zero TypeScript, it would be great to have kind of a level two scenario where there's literally no TypeScript at all, or like really little, like literally the code is there just to load Python code and then it's all done in Python. That's the dream. But when we get to that, I don't know.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, Madeline, I did not mean to
it's okay.
Start a language war here or anything. It's just about personal preference.
I'm not sure we're ever going to get rid of TypeScript, given that, well, VS Code is written in TypeScript, right? So there needs to be one way or one place where we bridge back into the VS Code APIs, right? But I could definitely see a day where most of the extension is written in Python and then the only TypeScript is there for you to bridge back into using the VS Code APIs, or maybe even JavaScript. It would lower the barrier of entry to at least contributing to the Python extension, because it is a bit silly these days. Like, in order to contribute to the Python extension, you need to know not Python, but TypeScript.
Well, so, I mean, there's an actual possibility where you might not somehow need to know even TypeScript, right? So Dirk, who's on our team, is actually looking into WASI, which is the WebAssembly system interface. And he's researching what it would take to use WASI as a way to do extensions. And so you could see a future, I think, where instead of having a package.json that specifies how to package up some node code to become the thing that you run as an extension, you could theoretically have some other configuration that points at the WASM file that you compiled for your extension and just has to have the right named activate function. And it just knows how to load that up and run it and just knows what to grab, in which case you wouldn't even have to have TypeScript.
Our minds are blown now.
I mean, this is all very theoretical, very early days in terms of research, but I mean, it's something that the team's looking into as to the feasibility, right? So that people don't feel confined to TypeScript or the Node workflow. If people want to write an extension in Rust, why not? You want to write something in Go using TinyGo? Why not? If we can make it work, it opens up the possibility of easier extension development.
This is great. If that ends up happening, it will be great to re-listen to this episode and see where the thoughts starting to be formed.
I'm going to become a Go developer and make the Sad Go Girls Club podcast. See ya, everyone.
Not Russ.
I can be the Sad Rust Girls Club if you want. I am fine. Sad not TypeScript Girls Club. That's just me. I'm going to be over there writing TypeScript in my little corner. But it's okay. That was interesting. Yeah, there is WASI. I don't know what would be the biggest hurdle, learning like how to configure that WASI file or learning to set up the entire like TypeScript compilation toolchain in order to get your package.json and everything running. But I mean, it's all theoretical, right?
Yeah, I think that for that, it's going to be the workflow. What would have to get exposed into the WASM code? How would you expose it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a lot to think through.
Yeah.
WebAssembly doesn't necessarily translate back and forth cleanly in terms of objects. So like things that are very JavaScript-like in the VS Code API may not translate well for a WebAssembly solution. I mean, this is why it's all kind of theoretical and just kind of being poked at, and why it's just a partial WASI thing in the VS Code public VS Code roadmap. But who knows?
Yeah, let's see. But all this talk about phasing TypeScript out has made me sad. And because this is a sad girl podcast, it is time for the sad song question. Well, Brett and Luciana, because we didn't talk about it last week. What is your sad emo song from your sad emo times? Your favorite sad emo song, I guess, if you have several.
I can go first if Luciana wants.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So actually the one I'm going to mention, I'm going to say probably Undone, the Sweater Song by Weezer, partially because there's actually a Python connection. I don't know if everyone knows, but Rivers Cuomo, the lead singer of Weezer, is actually a Python coder.
Wow, really?
Yep. The Talk Python to Me podcast did an episode where they talked to like four other people who just use Python for just whatever day-to-day stuff to kind of point out that Python has uses beyond crazy big app development stuff, like helping develop photographs of black holes that were just announced the other day, thanks to Python. And he got Rivers Cuomo to come on, and he talked about how like he uses it to generate a Spotify playlist of music that he's never heard, to kind of get exposed to new stuff and to parse stuff about album sales. There's all sorts of just other stuff. But yeah, Rivers Cuomo is a Python developer.
That's pretty cool.
That's really awesome.
Yeah, funny enough, when my wife, Andrea, found out that fact, I think that was the proudest she ever was that I was a developer of the Python programming language, was the fact that maybe Rivers Cuomo maybe knows who I am because of the work I've done on Python and because of the podcasts I've been lucky enough to be on. That, I think, got her more excited about the work I've put in than anything else and any other accomplishment I've ever had, including getting software to Mars.
It's hard to compete with that, though. And now I'm like, I should have answered first because my answer is not as cool as that one.
It's okay. You get host privilege, Luciana.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I would have to pick a classic, Perfect by Simple Plan. I just listened to that song so much during my wannabe emo times. And well, when I moved to Canada, one of the things I was very proud of is that I was moving to the country of Simple Plan.
Oh, wait, Simple Plan's Canadian?
Yep.
They are Canadian, yes.
Oh, is this where I'm being told to leave Canada for not knowing this monument to the Canadian musical history?
No.
Not at all. When I arrived here, one of the bands I was very excited about as well was Nickelback, only to learn that every Canadian I was going to meet and talk to absolutely disliked, borderline hated Nickelback. So this is completely fine. What about yours, Madeline? I want to hear your favorite emo song.
Oh, for me, I'm a very, very mainstream person. So I want to say Wake Me Up When September Ends by Green Day. I really like the song. It's just, you know, a classic. I listen to it even when it's not September. Maybe I liked it because September was the beginning of school, you know, and I just wanted like school to be over and this and this and that. And when I listen to it these days, I'm like, oh man, all those memories from these years, like, just come back, but mostly the embarrassing memories, you know? So I'm like, okay, just skip the song. I do not want to relive that anymore. But talking about embarrassing memories and just being sad in general, so when I'm sad, I usually have ice cream, and I actually have some ice cream in the fridge right now to eat while I listen to my sad songs. So the second funny question of the podcast, which we did not talk about last week, and that I'm going to ask to Brett and Luciana again, is what is your favorite ice cream flavor? It doesn't have to be the flavor you eat when you listen to your favorite emo song, but it can be.
So that's a tricky question. We're really lucky in Vancouver to have some really awesome ice cream places. Like, I'm a huge fan of Ernest Ice Cream, and they change up their menu every month. And I only recently, like in the last year, have been able to have dairy again because I lost my ability to digest dairy like a decade ago. And it's finally come back mostly. And so it's shifted me back to be able to have dairy ice cream, which has opened up a whole new world again back to ice cream. My friends were all like shocked and devastated more than I think I was when I lost the ability to digest dairy, because if you ever came over to my place and were around long enough to have ice cream for dessert, I was notorious for dishing out massive bowls of ice cream, like small, medium, large, and cannon-sized bowls of ice cream. And it was no joke. Like, I always had to ask everyone what size they want, and then I had to go down a size from what I thought was that. So people said small. I thought it was like extra small. Like, if they said large, they actually meant a medium. Anyway, I was a slight ice cream addict, as it were. Anyway, if you were to take me to any random ice cream joint, I would probably gravitate towards Cookies and Cream, just because it's one of those ones that if you nail it, it's great. But if you don't, it really says a lot about your ice cream shop, right? Because it's a fairly simple flavor, but it's easy to get wrong, right? Like, if you don't get the vanilla right and it's not creamy, and they get used cheap cookies and it doesn't work well. Slightly more esoteric is cookie dough. And then if you really want more esoteric, we're getting into like chocolate peanut butter pretzel from Ernest.
We went from something very widespread to very, very niche ice cream. I wonder what that says about you, Brett.
It says I once bought how many liters? Like some obscene number of liter tub from Ernest Ice Cream once. So I think it says I like ice cream potentially a little too much.
A wheelbarrow full of ice cream.
It was a lot.
What about you, Luciana? What's your favorite ice cream flavor?
I will go with Double Oreo by Mister, which is also an ice cream place here in Vancouver. Very local today.
So what's the difference between Double Oreo and Cookies and Cream?
This Double Oreo, the base is a chocolate base, so not vanilla. And the cookies is actually Oreo, but a lot of it.
The other thing to mention about Mister is they use liquid nitrogen to freeze the ice cream right there in front of you.
Yes.
So there's an extra bit of uniqueness to Luciana's pick.
Exactly. It's very creamy.
So if anybody's listening to the podcast, now you have a couple of ice cream shop recommendations in Vancouver if you ever wanted to have ice cream here. I like the ice cream bars from Mr. Ice Cream. I don't think I've ever had ice cream in a cup from them, though.
They're great. But what is your favorite?
Well, I don't have any like shop references. My favorite flavor of all time is pistachio, but like good pistachio, not highlighter green pistachio, not radioactive pistachio. Like, I like good pistachio ice cream. I'm still looking for it in Vancouver. Maybe I'll go check out Ernest and Mister. Maybe like Rocky Point ice cream in Port Moody.
Or Rain or Shine. Rain or Shine is another good one to try locally.
Ooh, I'll give it a try. And then my second favorite ice cream flavor that I discovered this week is ube flavor. So like purple yam.
What?
Ube, U-B-E.
Oh.
Purple yam.
Wow. Where's that from?
Well, you can buy tubs of it that's safe at the moment from Walls because it's like Walls ice cream with a heart-shaped logo. I think they just entered the Canadian market or something like that. And so they released like 3 international ice cream flavors. So like ube, so like purple yam, bubble tea, which is flavors of Taiwan. And another flavor, which I do not remember the name of, which is inspired by Indian flavors.
Okay.
Give it a try and let me know what you think. You can find it at Safeway.
I love it. Thank you for the recommendation.
All right. Well, I think that's pretty much it for us today. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Brett, and telling us about your origin story. It's funny. We went from our origin story last episode to your origin story this episode, and a little bit about the WWBD and general plans for the Python extension. Thanks for joining, Brett. Thanks for joining and co-hosting this with me, Luciana.
Thank you for hosting, Kim Adeline. And thanks. Really, really appreciate you being here, Brett.
And thanks to both of you for having me.
All right, that's it for today's episode of the Sad Python Girls Club podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope to see you again soon.